Hey, it's Tom and Jenny from 13 O'Clock, and we have a couple of announcements to make.
Yeah. Well, why don't you tell them what's going on?
Well, first thing, we have put up a Patreon page, and we're going to talk about that some in the episode, but I just wanted to get it out here. Yeah. Now, I wanted to make this announcement before this episode because we have left Project Entertainment Network.
Yeah, we left on good terms, though.
Yeah. Right. So, and we recorded this episode before we knew that we were going to leave. So that's why I kind of wanted to put this in front, because there's still like a lot of Project Entertainment shout outs. And you should totally still go listen to Project Entertainment Network and their other shows and go to their Patreon and all that other kind of stuff like we normally say. There's no, there is no bad blood between us. It's totally fine.
What happened is we slowly kind of evolved into more of a YouTube show than a podcast. It came from a podcast, but really all of our action and all of our interaction with the public comes from our YouTube show.
Yeah, most of it is YouTube listeners, and we kind of wanted to concentrate more on that.
Yeah, and when we opened a Patreon account up, it put some conflicts in.
Yeah, we would have a conflict of interest with Project Entertainment Network, because they are running a Patreon to pay for all of their podcasts, and rather than step on their toes and, you know, take money away from their podcast, we thought we would just go our own way and go independent.
Yeah, I thought we had permission to open a Patreon, but it turned
out
that
it was just a misunderstanding.
And we're allowed a personal Patreon page, but not a 13 O'Clock podcast page. And really, once we kind of looked at the numbers and saw where everything was coming from, it was more in our advantage to go our own way.
So, yeah, we talked to Armand Rosamilia, who runs the Project Entertainment Network. We talked to him this morning, and we decided that we were just going to take 13 O'Clock totally independent, and so there wouldn't be any more conflict of interest with the Patreons and all that other kind of thing. So that's what we decided to do. Now, if you are listening to our show on YouTube, then this will probably not really affect you in the slightest. There will still be new shows coming up every Tuesday, just like always. The only difference will be there will be less commercials, basically. So good for you. Now, if you are listening to us on just the audio version of the podcast, then probably you will have a slightly different experience. What I'm doing right now, I'm not super savvy about about all of this podcast hosting and stuff like that, but I do have a blog that I've been posting to the entire time that the show has been up, and it's at 13oclockpodcast.wordpress.com, and there is a feed there where you should be able to download the audio versions, hopefully. I have them hosted on archive.org, so you can get them from there also. And so, although it may be like a little sketchy for a few weeks until I get everything sorted out, until I, you know, get everything together about who's downloading where from what. So we might get behind on a couple, but it should be okay. So if you want the audio version only and not the YouTube, then just go to 13oclockpodcast.wordpress.com and the audio file will be there. Or you can download it from archive.org. We have a page there called 13 O'Clock Podcast. Also, you can get it from there. So you should still be able to get it if you're on the audio version. Like I said, YouTube, it shouldn't make any difference at all. It'll still be new shows up every Tuesday, and there won't be any difference there. So hopefully this will be a positive move for us. And like I said, we have just put up a Patreon page, and we talk about it some on this episode, so I won't really, like, you know, flog a dead horse or anything like that. But you definitely should go to patreon.com/13oclockpodcast. And we have some kind of cool extra stuff up there at the moment. And we're going to put some more extra content up there as the weeks go on. So please check that out and enjoy this episode of 13 O'Clock. Thank you very much. Tom had to leave. That's why he wasn't on the last couple minutes, in case you wondered.
In 1945, on the slopes of Nian Hill, an event took place which brought witchcraft into the national dailies. A particularly gruesome murder was committed, which soon became known as the Witchcraft Murder.
And it's us again. Welcome to episode 49.
Murder by Witchcraft.
Yeah, with a question mark, because they're not really sure. Okay. But, you know.
So the premise of the show is, did some people successfully kill somebody else using witchcraft?
No, it's not so much that. It was just that these two particular murders that took place in England in the 1940s, particularly in the Midlands, the motive for them has been presumed that maybe it had something to do with witchcraft, that they were killed in like an occult ritual type of murder.
So we're talking about two occult murders.
Yeah, or, you know, ostensibly occult murders. I don't know if they really were.
All right, let's do some housekeeping. We've got to talk about Patreon.
Yes. This is big news. I was actually going to wait until episode 50 to put up the Patreon page and make the announcement. But, you know, what the hell. We went ahead and put up a Patreon page.
That's right. And there's some bonus material on there.
Yeah, we have already put up, you know, for $5, $10, and $20, those are the tiers. And for the $5 and up, we're going to put, like, a bunch of Patreon-only posts and stuff like that. And we already have a couple things up there. We put up, like, a half-hour thing of us talking about cheesy music documentaries.
Yeah.
I put up about a five-minute teaser for my new true crime book, The Faceless Villain, which is coming out. You know, so we're going to keep every, you know, few days I want to put up some more bonus material.
We're going to have cool bonus stuff on there.
Yeah, of us, like, talking about various other topics. And
so far we have three patrons, so I want to give a shout-out to them. One of them's Dan Meekin in the UK. He's a heavy lifter. And then there's somebody just goes by the name of MS, pretty much a heavy lifter, too. And then there's Veronica Vatter. Thanks, Veronica. Now, we want to tell you something. The minimum we have listed in the pay scale is 5. But it doesn't have to be 5. You can send $1.
Yeah.
Two. It'll take it.
Any amount
is good. Any amount is great.
And honestly, any amount that you pledge will get you access to our Patreon.
All the bonus stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Now, at 20, we're going to send our heavy lifters some merch.
Yeah.
It'll be things like shirts, t-shirts, signed stuff, like maybe some autographed books, things like that.
Stickers, bookmarks.
I think we have a few magnets.
Yeah, with magnets, us on postcards, stuff like that.
But it's all just going to depend on what we have at what time. They'll probably get something sent out every 3 months or so.
Yeah, that's what I was planning on. I'm going to kind of keep to a schedule. Like if you are in the tier that gets merchandise, I'm going to send stuff out 4 times a year. It's going to be September 15th, December 15th, March 15th, and June 15th. That's when I'm going to do the mail outs. That's what I'm planning.
Yeah, and we're also going to do online hangouts. I think that starts at the $5 tier, right? Or at the $10.
The $10 tier. $10. That starts at the $10
tier. There's a $10 tier? Okay. Okay.
So we're going to invite people. We're going to do like monthly. I'm either going to do a monthly Google Hangout or alternate Google Hangout and live chat on Patreon. I'll probably do those like the last weekend of the month, starting at the end of August. So however many $10 and up patrons we have at that point, then, you know, you'll get an invite and we'll try to figure out what day and time is best for everybody and all that kind of stuff.
So a big thanks to our first 3 patrons.
Yeah. And if anybody wants to give us some money, then go to patreon.com/13oclockpodcast. And there we are with our cute little video.
Yeah. And for our podcast people, anything you can contribute would be more than welcome.
And I would also like to mention,
if you want to keep the show going, then, you know.
It's gonna help us, you know, expand.
It'll help us improve the show, too.
And improve the show to get better equipment and all that kind of stuff. I also want to mention Project Entertainment Network. They're, all, as always, doing a great job. They also have a Patreon, which is at patreon.com/projectentnet. So if you want to go give them a couple bucks, then that would be greatly appreciated, too. Because that helps our show, and it helps all the other shows that are on the network with us, which are all quite awesome.
Yeah, they usually use that money for promotional stuff to help advertise the entire network.
Yeah, and they also buy advertising for our show in various other formats and things like that. So that really does help us out, as well as helps out all the other shows on the network. So, you know, if you want to go and help them out, too, then that would be awesome. And what else are we going to... Oh, okay, let's mention again Spooky Empire, which is coming up the weekend before Halloween, the 27th, 28th, and the 29th of October. And we will both be there all 3 days, and we will be on several of the panels. We're doing the Sick and Twisted panel on Friday night. We're actually kind of in charge of that. You know, we're going to be on various other panels over the weekend. We will be out at the table. We'll be selling books. We'll be interacting with the public. So if you're in the Orlando, Florida area the weekend before Halloween, then come out and meet us and hang out with us and drink with us. You know, it'll be fun.
Okay. Unseen Hands doing well. Ratings have been really good on it.
Yeah, I've been getting a lot of really good reviews recently.
The audiobook's pretty popular.
Yeah.
So, and Faceless Villain's coming soon.
Yeah.
Book about a bunch of unsolved murders.
Yeah. Eventually, it's going to be 3 volumes. Volume 1 should be out. I'm trying to get it out before Spooky Empire.
Yeah.
So I'll have some copies there to sell to people.
There are a lot of unsolved murder fans out there in the market, so I think this is going to be a good series.
Yeah.
I think they're going to like
it. And actually, the two cases we're discussing on the show today are going to be in this volume.
Okay.
So, because they happened in the 40s. This first volume is going to be covering, like, creepy unsolved murders from, like, 1900 to 1959, I think is the cutoff year.
Yeah.
And then the second volume will be, you know, later years, and then the third volume will be up to the present day.
And 13 o'clock in minutes, our other channel's growing. You know, it's just starting. I think it has 25 subs, something like that. But we'd really appreciate it if you guys would subscribe to that one also.
Yeah. So far, we have 11 videos up. I just put one up a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
It was creepiest abandoned places on earth or something.
Yeah. If you've got a big old smart TV, it's cool to put that thing on and just let them run through all of them. It's got that kind of hypnotic music and all those graphics going. It looks cool.
Yeah. And I also want to say shout out to a lot of the, I get a lot of my music clips and sound effects from freesound.org. All the users whose stuff I used, I put their names in the credits of the YouTube videos just to give them a little bit of credit. I mean, I usually layer them and slow them down or speed them up or do various things to kind of make it sound original, you know, so I'm not just swiping other people's music. So anyway, go subscribe to 13 o'clock in minutes. That's our latest channel. I'm going to try and put up at least two videos a month is what I'm shooting for.
Yeah.
And hopefully if all you guys go and subscribe and, you know, that'll be cool. All right. So we got most of that out of the way, I think.
Yeah, we're done with all that. All right. Let's get to the case. Yeah, I'm impatient. I know the audience is impatient too, but that's just stuff we have to do.
Yeah. Okay. Today we are talking about two murders that took place in the 1940s.
Yeah, and I don't know anything about these, so I'm riding along just like I'm the audience.
Yeah, and these are pretty well-known murders still to this day, just because they were so creepy. And like I said, they're sort of related in the sense that they happened only about 50 miles apart. They happened, you know, a couple years apart. And because the motive for them was sometimes seen to have been something to do with witchcraft, one more than the other. The first one we're going to talk about is the case that's popularly known as Who Put Bella in the Witch Elm.
What's a witch elm?
It's a tree.
Okay.
It's a type of tree. And that is a bone of contention because I read a lot of sources because, like I said, I researched this case for my book, The Faceless Villain. And this kind of a bone of contention because even though popularly the tree was said to have been a witch elm, it's actually, some sources say it was actually a witch hazel tree. Not that it really matters, but, you know, witch elm sounds cooler, okay. I guess. But so basically this is what happened. It was a Sunday morning. It was April 18th, 1943. World War II was in full swing. And there was a bit of woods in the English Midlands. And it was owned by, it was part of the estate of a gent named Lord Cobham. And it was called Hagley Wood. And he had like this really large estate. Now on this particular day, there were four boys, teenagers, and they were poaching in the woods. They were looking for birds' nests for whatever reason. And so they were kind of poking around in the woods looking for a good tree to find some bird's nests. So they find this witch elm or witch hazel tree, whichever it is. And they said, that looks like a good place for there to be some bird's nests that we could collect. So one of the boys, Bob Farmer, who was 15, climbed up the tree to see what he could see. So while he's up there, he peers down into the hollow of the tree and sees what at first he thinks is an animal skull. So he thinks, neato, and he pulls it out. Except guess what? It's not an animal skull. It's a human skull. And it's still got hair on it and everything.
Now, how high up was he when he found this body?
It didn't really say. I don't think it was super high up.
So the hole that he reached into was in the top of the trunk somehow?
Yeah, or the tree was broken off or something. They're not really sure.
They weren't real specific
about
how
it was. Yeah, it wasn't real specific.
So it wasn't a case where somebody climbed a tree and then just slid down and fell into the trunk and couldn't get out.
No, I don't see how that would have happened at any point.
So they were dead when they went in.
Yeah.
They were dead when they went in the tree.
Okay. Yeah.
Because I'd imagine if it was something that simple, then the case would have just been dismissed as an accident.
Well, yeah.
So that's, okay.
Well,
so now we're getting into the case.
I'm getting ahead. You're always like jumping ahead.
I got to get ahead. Well, yeah, I'm a man, and that's how a man, man's trying to think in a mechanical method.
Right, but
you
don't know anything about the case yet.
I know that. So I'm going to start asking questions.
So stop assuming things that you don't know anything about.
You know how it is. I'm going to check my testosterone.
So at first, like the boys, you know, he pulls out the skull and they're like, holy shit, you guys, that's a human skull, right? But then they thought, well, we're technically not supposed to be in these woods because it's not our property. So we're just going to keep this on the DL. So they put the skull back in the tree and then they amscrate.
Yeah.
Well, luckily for history, one of the boys, the youngest, he felt a little bad about it. And then that evening, he told his dad, "Hey, Dad, we were poaching in the woods and we found a skull in a tree." So the dad called the police. Now, the police went out to the woods the next day and found the tree. In the tree, aside from the skull, was also an entire skeleton, except for one of the hands. Now, the hand was found outside of the tree, kind of scattered like in some underbrush. It was buried a little bit. Now, the skeleton was, you know, when they examined it, it was clearly that of a woman, a rather small woman. She was only about 5 feet tall. Presumably, this woman was not English. I believe they could tell just because of some of the things that she had on her, like her clothing and things like that. She was wearing a gold wedding ring, or rather a gold wedding ring was found with the skeleton. And a few various other things were found, shoes and stuff. Also, there was a piece of taffeta stuffed into the mouth.
What is a taffeta?
It's a piece of material, fabric. It's kind of like that fabric that they make poofy prom dresses and stuff out of.
Okay.
So they presumed that this is how she was killed, that she was suffocated by having the taffeta crammed into her mouth. They also noted a few other things. Her teeth were very crooked, you know, which they hoped would make her easy to identify, and various other things. So the taffeta in the mouth was the only obvious injury to the body. So, like I said, they assumed that that's how she had been killed. The pathologist also made a note that it's like she must have been stuffed into the tree pretty soon after she was killed, because if rigor mortis had set in, she wouldn't have fit, because apparently it was very narrow. Yeah, while she was still limp. So she had been stuffed into this tree very shortly after she was murdered. Taking into account the fact that she had these specific teeth that were very unusual, they started combing all the dental records in the area and trying to match them up with various missing persons records from around the area. No match. Nothing came up. Now, they presumed that this woman had had some dental work about a year prior to her death. I could guess they could tell that from the skull. But again, they found no dental surgeries in the area that would have done it or had any record of her, of the x-rays or anything like that. And you have to imagine, too, that, you know, this was in the middle of World War II. There was rationing. There were air raids. There were all kinds of things going on. There were people coming and going. You know, so after a while, since they hadn't been able to identify her, the case goes cold. Oh, I forgot to mention, too, that from the pathology report, they determined that the woman had actually been in the tree for about 18 months. So she had been dead for about a year and a half.
Okay.
Like I said, they had no idea who she was. About a year and a half after the skeleton was found, there appeared a strange piece of graffiti on a wall in a nearby town. And this graffiti read, "Who put Bella down the witch elm? Hagley Wood."
What?
So police, Hagley Wood was the name of the forest where the body was found.
Okay, all right.
And the witch elm was the type of tree it was. Now, they had no idea if whoever wrote this weird piece of graffiti actually knew who this woman was, because they didn't know who the woman was. They didn't know if her name was Bella, if that was her real name or whatever.
They just made it up, right?
Or if this was just some person that was making things up. But because this seemed so specific, they thought they had better investigate, you know, that maybe there was something to this. Maybe that was her name. And this graffiti turned up in various other places, too. Sometimes it said, "Who put Luabella down the witch elm?" You know, it was always variations of that kind of thing.
Right.
And it looked like the same person who wrote it, but they weren't really sure. And they never did find the person that was writing it. From this, there emerged three distinct possibilities. The first possibility was that this was simply a prostitute. A prostitute from Birmingham came forward in 1944 and told the police that there had been a prostitute who went by the name of Bella that used to work the streets around Hagley Wood and stuff like that, and had kind of disappeared sometime around 1941. Police did investigate this possibility. Nothing really came of that. The second possibility, which is kind of relevant to the topic of the show we're talking about, is that folklorist Margaret Murray, who was quite famous, made much of the fact that Bella's hand was found separately from the rest of her body. Now, she thought that this might imply that whoever had killed her had killed her in some sort of occult ritual, like they were making a Hand of Glory, which I'm not sure if you guys probably know what that is. If you're listening to that show, if you're listening to the show, you probably know what a Hand of Glory is. But it was, you know, go see the Wicker Man. They have one of those in there. But it's, you know, it's basically a hand they make out of a corpse, and you know, they use it. They usually use it to get in and out of people's houses without being seen. That's the spell anyway.
Okay.
So yeah, Margaret Murray thought it was pretty weird that the hand had been found separate from the body, which does seem kind of weird. I mean, I guess an animal could have done it, but why just that one hand? You know what I mean? So for a long time, the witchcraft thing, because of the hand, was kind of the only thing going. Like, a lot of people seemed, yeah, it must have been that, and then there was all this weird graffiti and all this other stuff, so it seemed kind of mystical and stuff like that. However, many years later, I believe it was in 1953, a third possibility presented itself.
They were still trying to investigate this murder.
Well, yeah, because what ended up happening, it's just like, because like I said, the case went cold, the woman was never identified, but every now and then more graffiti would turn up, which would kind of raise more interest in the case, and then people would kind of go back and investigate and things like that. So in 1953, there was a letter received, and this letter was from a woman named Una Mossop. And she claimed that her husband, Jack, who was dead now in 1953, had worked in a munitions factory during the war in the Midlands. Now, Jack Mossop had apparently known this Dutch man, and this Dutch man was a Nazi spy. And he had given Jack a whole bunch of money so Jack would give some information about the munitions factories in the Birmingham area and given it to the Nazis and stuff like that. Now, Jack claimed that one day he had been meeting this Dutch guy at a pub or something like that. That was his connection. And the Dutch guy had a woman with him who was also Dutch. And that at some point, the man and the woman began to argue and the Dutch man strangled the woman. And then Jack said that he and the Dutch man had gone to Hagley Wood and stuffed the woman inside the tree. Now, subsequently, according to Jack's wife, and like I said, Jack was dead at this point. This was his wife claiming that he had said all this. According to his wife, Una, Jack had to be institutionalized later on because he kept having recurring nightmares about a woman staring at him from a tree. Right?
Yeah.
So what this was investigated. Now, whether or not it was true or not, no one really knows. But
it sounds plausible.
The Nazi spy angle is actually fairly plausible. Like, I know it sounds weird, but it was the middle of World War II. Several Nazi spies had been captured in this particular area. I mean, the English Midlands, that was where a lot of the munitions factories were. Right. So the Germans would have been parachuting in there, and a couple of them did get caught parachuting in there. Because they were trying to get information about the munitions, so where they could bomb and things like that. Also, there were a couple possibilities, too. There was a woman who was supposedly a Dutch Nazi spy who had parachuted into the area sometime around 1941, when the woman in the tree was supposed to have died. And she went by the code name Clarabella. There was also a possibility that she could have been a Dutch woman named Clarabella Dronkers, who was a known Nazi spy. And in fact, another spy, a male spy, who also had the last name of Dronkers, was actually executed in England in 1942, I believe. There was also, a few years later, they captured a Gestapo agent. He was a Czech, and his name was Joseph Jacobs. When he was captured, they found a picture on his person of his girlfriend, who was a German actress and cabaret singer named Clara Bowerly, which could be seen as Clarabelle or Clarabella. Right. And she was apparently a Nazi spy, and she was his connection there. This did kind of seem, it did seem like maybe it could have been her, because she had some kind of fucked up looking teeth too, just like the woman in the tree. And also, it said that after 1941, no one ever in Germany ever saw her again, because she was kind of well known, like in the cabaret scene and stuff like that. And they said, you know, she never had any albums come out after that time, or she never, you know, whatever. So they don't know if that was really her, but it does seem like a possibility. The only thing that's kind of against that is that the skeleton they found in the tree, they think was only about 5 feet tall. Right. Now, Clara Bowerly was supposed to be quite a bit taller than that. So they're not really sure, but like I said, the witchcraft angle was kind of like the first thing, and that was mostly because of the hand.
Right.
The Nazi spy thing, even though there's not a great deal of evidence to support that either, it seems like a more likely scenario, right, just because, although I have to say, if she really was a Nazi spy and she was killed by other Nazi spies for whatever reason, because she was messing up their mission, because who knows? But why would they take her body out to this remote English field, basically, or English forest, which maybe they didn't even know the area that well, and then stuff her in a tree, like kind of climb up a tree and stuff her in a tree? Like, why would they do that?
Well, just because she was a spy doesn't mean it would be legal to kill her.
No, I know that, but I mean, it seems like a lot of trouble to go through.
Well, they were trying to hide the murder. You know, maybe the guys that killed her didn't know she was a German spy.
Yeah.
You know, they just were going to kill her for other reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like such a weird story. Like, to me, it seems like there probably was some Nazi connection. But the weird thing, too, is that there might have been some kind of cover-up because the body was lost, the skeleton was lost, and the autopsy report was lost, conveniently.
Maybe somebody in the British intelligence agencies knew who she was.
Maybe.
And they didn't want it to come out.
But it.
I guarantee the death was probably accidental, per se. It was a murder. It wasn't something ordered by the government.
Yeah, because it didn't seem like an assassination.
No.
It seemed more like, I mean, stuffing fabric into someone's throat and suffocating them, that seems more like a crime of passion than an assassination.
Yeah, and if the government wants you dead, especially back in those days, you just get disappeared. You're never found.
Yeah.
No one ever knows about it.
True. But the strange thing
Or they have a show trial and everyone knows about it, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Regardless of whether she was just a random prostitute that got murdered, whether she was killed in some weird occult ceremony, or whether she was a Nazi spy who was killed for whatever reason.
I really doubt the occult angle. The whole hand thing, that's coincidence. Maybe the way the body was stuffed in the tree, the hand was more towards the opening.
And then an animal grabbed it and...
Or decomposed, it fell off, and then the rain came and it rolled a little while, and it was natural.
And really, I mean, the only reason that I think that the occult angle gained so much steam, not only because it was Margaret Murray saying it, so because, like I said, she's quite a famous folklorist, but also because of the next murder we're going to talk about, which actually seemed a lot more like a witchcraft or occult type murder. So I think that the two cases became associated, even though they might not be. But that area of England, I mean, the Midlands of England, there was like a lot of kind of pagan-y, witchcrafty looking shit, because there were a lot of people that had those kind of superstitions still, even in the 1940s. I mean, the thing about the Bella and the Witch Elm case is that, one, never solved. They still don't know who that woman is. They still don't know who killed her or why. And the weird thing, too, is that every now and then, you still get some of that graffiti. There's like a stone obelisk.
It must have become a meme.
That's what I was thinking, that it was kind of like a Kilroy was here type of thing, where people are just going around like putting that up on the on the thing. Because, and especially now that the case is so prevalent on the internet.
Sure.
That I think a lot of people got interested in it, so kind of revived the whole Bella and the Witch Elm graffiti. But yeah, so actually we're getting to the halfway point right now, so let's take a break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about another way more witchcrafty type murder.
So you were just getting warmed up with this
one. Yeah. So the next one we're going to talk about is the Charles Walton murder, known as the Pitchfork Murder or the Witchcraft Murder. This one's actually kind of intriguing. All right, so we'll be back in just a few minutes. Hey, 13 O'Clock fans. Love the show, but don't have an hour to spare? Check out our new list channel, 13 O'Clock in Minutes. All the fun, creepy topics of the main podcast, but in easy-to-swallow, bite-sized pieces. Links in the description. More videos to come soon.
The Unseen Hand. A New Exploration of Poltergeist Phenomena by Jenny Ashford. Author of The Rochdale Poltergeist, House of Fire and Whispers, and The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. The Unseen Hand is a comprehensive collection of over 100 reported poltergeist cases from the first century to the present day. All the best-known cases are presented, from the Bell Witch to Jeff the Talking Mongoose, from Rosenheim to Tina Resch, from Enfield to the Entity. A large selection of fascinating and lesser-known accounts from all over the world are also included, and all contain testimony from the most eerie and extraordinary events. The Unseen Hand is the ultimate compendium for readers interested in poltergeist disturbances throughout history and the theories behind what causes them. On sale now from Amazon in print, ebook, and audiobook formats. Go to Unseen Hand Book on Facebook and visit www.jennyashford.com for more information.
Thornback, talking about witchcraft murders. This is another quite famous unsolved murder, and this one has a lot more witchcrafty details, as I said. This took place on Valentine's Day, 1945, and this was in Warwickshire, very near to Shakespeare country, only a few miles from Stratford-upon-Avon. A lot of legends around that area, like I said, a lot of druid-type shit, all this kind of stuff, which kind of contributed to this case kind of being associated with that. So it's Valentine's Day, and there's a 74-year-old man. He's a farm laborer, and his name is Charles Walton. He has lived his entire life in the village of Lower Quinton. He lives in a small cottage with his niece, Edith Walton, who he adopted when she was 3 years old, after her mother died. He heads off to work, as he does every day. He leaves the house at 8 a.m. 4 p.m. comes around. Edith comes home, and her uncle is not there. Now she starts to worry because he is a creature of habit. And so she rounds up a couple friends and the farmer that Charles Walton had been working for, Alfred Potter, and says, you know, let's go look for him. So they go out to the farm where he had been cutting some hedges that day. Underneath an oak tree, they find his body. He has been bashed in the head with his own walking stick. His throat has been slashed. And some accounts say that he had a cross drawn on his chest with a billhook, which is like a scythe kind of thing, like a thick scythe. Also, his body has been pinned to the ground by his own pitchfork.
Damn.
Obviously, this seems a little strange. The pitchfork had been embedded into the old guy's body so severely that it took two big burly guys to pull it out.
Man.
It had gone, like, all the way through him, all the way through his flesh, bone, all the way into the ground, into the ground. 6 inches.
Okay.
So, immediately, rumors started to circulate around the town. This is a small town, less than 500 people.
Right.
That Charles Walton had been the victim of an evil eye murder. Some kind of black magic ritual.
Okay.
It's also important to note that near where the body was found is an area called Meon Hill. And Meon Hill has, for many centuries, been considered to be a place of druidic sacrifice. Apparently there's a tree that grows there that was like a witching tree where, like, you know, covens would come and have meetings and stuff like that. Some people also found it suspicious that the murder had taken place on Valentine's Day, which in the old calendar corresponded to Candlemas or the Celtic festival of Imbolc, which, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, probably not. But apparently that was kind of a date when you would do sacrifices to kind of, you know, nourish the land and things like that. Now, at first, I mean, when the police came, and they even, this murder was so strange that they even got Chief Inspector Robert Fabian, who was actually quite famous. They actually made a TV show or a radio show about him later on called Fabian of the Yard. He's from Scotland Yard. And he actually came to investigate. Now, him and all the other investigators, they interviewed all 493 residents of the town of Lower Quinton. And at the time, they said that the townsfolk seemed very reticent. They didn't really want to talk to the police. They seemed very, I don't know if they seemed sort of secretive, but they were just kind of like, yeah, we don't know anything or we don't want to talk.
So they're kind of painting a Wicker Man type situation.
Yeah, it definitely did come across that way.
Okay.
Although at first, I don't think Robert Fabian was really down with the whole witchcraft thing at first until one of the other investigators handed him this book. And the book was called Folklore, Old Customs, and Superstitions in Shakespeare Land. And it kind of talked about the area of Warwickshire and how, you know, going back centuries that there are all these kind of, you know, legends associated with this particular area near where the body was found. And he also pointed out that described in this book, there was another murder that took place 70 years before that had a lot of parallels with the Charles Walton murder. Now, according to this book, it said that there was a woman named Anne Turner. She was 80 years old, and this happened in 1875. She had lived in the town of Lower Quinton. Apparently, someone else in the town named James Haywood, who was kind of a simpleton, let's put it like that, kind of village idiot type guy. He started to believe that Anne Turner was a witch and that she had cast an evil eye over the town that had made all these cattle die and had made crops fail and things like that. And James Haywood evidently killed Ann Taylor by pinning her to the ground with a pitchfork and carving a cross into her body.
Now, this didn't happen on any kind of anniversary of that murder, did it?
No.
Okay. So,
like I said, but it did happen on a significant date in the in the occult calendar, I guess you could say. He also pointed out that there had been a lot of you know, kind of witchcraft legends associated with that area, and probably one of the most famous ones was that of like phantom black dogs, right? So there's like all these black dogs seen around this area of Meon Hill.
Right.
So because of this particular book. And because the murder of Charles Walton was seen as ostensibly similar to that, to the murder of Ann Turner several years before, so they started to look at the witchcraft angle. Now, they did note that there had been some things going on in Lower Quinton that might have inspired this type of thing. The crops had failed the year before. The farmer that Charles Walton was working for, his some of his cattle had died. So maybe some of the townsfolk started to believe, well, maybe somebody, for some reason, blames Charles Walton or thought he was a witch, and so thought they would take care of it and use him as a sort of sacrifice. Because they said the way that he was found and the way that he was murdered would have caused like his blood to flow into the ground and stuff like that, which is a very, you know, occult type of thing to do. There was also the matter of Meon Hill being, you know, associated with witchcraft and stuff for probably like 2,000 years. One of the main legends about this area is that of the phantom black dogs. Now, in this book that the investigator showed to Fabian, there was also a story about a young boy who was walking around the area, and on three consecutive nights, or on several consecutive nights, he was passed by a black dog, which is supposedly a harbinger of death. And on the third night that the boy saw this dog, the dog either turned into a headless woman or a headless woman, like, appeared next to the black dog.
Okay. Wow.
And the little boy ran home, freaked out, and then discovered that his sister had died.
Damn.
Now, it should be noted that the little boy in this legend was named Charles Walton, just like the guy who was murdered.
Okay.
So a lot of people thought, well, maybe that was him as a kid. You know what I mean? Yeah. So maybe there's some kind of connection there. There are also legends that Robert Fabian, the chief investigator, that he also saw a black dog in the area running around, like, after the murder when he was investigating it. And some sources say that he found a black dog hanging in a tree near where the body was found. So, really, they didn't have a lot of leads. One person said, oh, they saw this man near where there was and looked like he was washing blood off. They did catch that guy. He was an Italian guy. He was a prisoner of war. And he was from a nearby POW camp, which was actually not so much a POW prison as it was just a place where people stayed because they could wander around and go to the movies or whatever.
Minimum security.
Yeah, it was minimum security. So this guy had apparently, and he'd been out poaching for food. And when they tested the blood that they found on him, it was rabbit blood. So his story checked out. So it wasn't him. There were also rumors that maybe Charles Walton's friend, George Higgins, had killed him. But, you know, not really any motive. George Higgins was an old man.
Right.
So they didn't really think he was going around doing that kind of shit.
It's unlikely that an old guy just busts loose.
Unlikely. Robbery, also unlikely. Charles Walton didn't have a lot of money, and the money that he did have was still in his house. So really the only other suspect was the man that Charles Walton had been working for, Alfred Potter, who was a farmer. Now, there were a couple sketchy things about Potter. When he was, I mean, he was one of the people that initially found the body, him and Edith and like one other person. When the police got there, he was actually going to leave before the police arrived. But then the police arrived just as he was leaving because he was kind of like, yeah, whatever, fuck this shit. Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Now, the police said he was acting a little strange. He was complaining about being cold. He seemed very nervous. He made a point of saying that if they found his fingerprints on the murder weapons, it was because he had touched them while he was checking to see if Charles Walton was still alive, which seemed a little weird. The police didn't find any fingerprints on the murder weapons, but, you know, they just thought it was strange that he made a point of saying that.
I don't know. That's kind of understandable.
Yeah. Also, he kind of had a couple differing stories about what he was doing that day, like right around the time when Charles Walton would have died. Like at first he said, I was at a pub with two of my employees. And then another time he said, I was checking on this heifer that was wounded or something like that. So, you know, he kind of came up with different stories, different alibis about what he was doing that day.
Sometimes that happens.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Or, you know, and at some points he's like,
there's not very specific about what time it was. And I kind of, you know, I kind of understand.
Right. So the story changed a couple times, but it wasn't anything that was like super egregious.
Right, yeah.
And the thing is that really, even though he was the only likely suspect they had, because they had no idea who else it could have been, there was really no reason for him to have done it.
Right.
I mean, here's the thing. They thought, maybe they had a fight, but there was no evidence of that. They said, maybe there was some kind of scam going on, or they were fighting about wages. The only thing weird that turned up about that was that Alfred Potter apparently reported more wages than he actually paid to Charles Walton, and then he would pocket the difference.
Right.
So really, he was benefiting from Charles Walton being alive and being working for him, because he was making extra money by saying, I'm paying him more, and, you know.
It doesn't sound like he killed a guy.
So, yeah. And so, like I said, it really didn't seem like he had any reason to.
Right.
Even though he acted kind of sketchy and stuff like that. So, despite all the investigation that they did, and it went on for a really long time, they took boot prints, they interviewed thousands of people, they had all the best minds on it from Scotland Yard and stuff like that. Never saw, no arrests were ever made. Really no, other than Potter, really no serious suspects.
Right.
And they kind of thought, and especially after when the kind of witchcraft shit about this came out, like I said, him being killed on Valentine's Day, and it also happened to be Ash Wednesday, which was also kind of a big significant date. And, you know, the way he was killed, the place he was killed. So I think people did kind of maybe associate it with witchcraft, but no one in the town would really give it up if somebody did kill him thinking he was a witch. Because there were rumors, evidently, some people in the town thought he was a witch, like he raised toads and sent the toads over people's fields and stuff. I don't know if he really did that, but there were like rumors. So it could have been that someone in the town thought he was to blame for the previous year's crop failure or for whatever reason and just decided to go out. It just seems weird to me that it happened in like broad daylight. It was like the middle of the day.
You know what it sounds like to me?
What is that?
That case that happened in Russia with the three teenagers that just ran around killing random people.
Yeah, that's right. I remember those.
What was the name of that case? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember.
Just kind of reminds me of that. It's like something that just a couple of teenagers on a rampage would do.
Yeah.
You know, they just run through. Hey, look at that old man. Let's kill him. You know, and then they run off.
Yeah, it could be. You know, it could have just been something as simple and random as that.
Yeah.
It just seemed like a labor-intensive way of killing someone.
Yeah, well,
it seemed ritualistic.
Well, if you look at the videos that those Russian kids took, they're enjoying it. They're you know, throwing bricks on guys, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Crushing them with I think it was a refrigerator. Yeah. Dropping a refrigerator on the guy and then throwing bricks on his head, and they were just laughing, having a good time, you know. It's nasty. And they hit him with a hammer. I think it's been a long time since I've seen it, but they had that video leaked on the internet. It was gross.
Yeah, I remember that. The thing, though, about this is that there's a lot of myth and legend surrounding the case that maybe make it more or less likely that it was a witchcraft murder. I think it might have been. It might have had that kind of aspect. Like I said, just because of that area at the time, there was so much superstition in that vein that it wouldn't have been crazy for someone to have murdered someone in that way. Now, it should be noted that the previous murder of the woman, Anne Turner, which had taken place 70 years before, was not as similar as it appeared on first blush. Now, she was killed because someone in the village thought she was a witch, and she was killed with a pitchfork. She wasn't pinned to the ground. She didn't have a cross for her or anything like that. She was actually killed in full view of many other villagers. The guy that killed her was, like I said, he was kind of the village idiot.
Right.
And he became convinced that her witchcraft had caused the crops to fail. So he was drunk one night and just came at her with a pitchfork and stabbed her, and she died later.
Yeah.
So, and there were numerous witnesses because it happened like in the middle of the street. So he was later put into a lunatic asylum. Now, there was also the story about the kid with the black dog and how that might have been the same Charles Walton. Probably not. I mean, one, that's a pretty common name. Two, the dates would have been about right, but you know, the whole fulcrum of the story was that these black dogs were portending the death of his sister. he did have three sisters, but they all lived. So they said unless his mom had some sister that died that no one knew about, then that probably wasn't the same guy. It should be noted, too, that there is speculation that Charles Walton might be related to Ann Turner in some way. That she is his great-grandson or is, you know, somewhat distantly related. So they're not real sure about that, but it's possible. Also, I think that at the time when Robert Fabian was talking about the case, and he was, I mean, as skeptical as he was, you know, the main guy from Scotland Yard and all this, he was quite famous at the time. And he seemed to, at first, think the whole witchcraft angle was, you know, a bunch of hooey, but I think the more he looked into it, the more convinced he became about that angle, though he never could solve it. All that being said, I think that some of the stuff he said about the townsfolk being secretive or not wanting to talk to them was maybe a little exaggerated. It could be that the townsfolk didn't really talk to him or didn't really tell him because maybe they didn't know anything. You know what I mean? It might not have been just them being assholes or trying to stonewall because they were covering up for something. It's like maybe they just really didn't know what was going on. And they definitely did seem like superstitious people. Right. Some of them did actually believe in witchcraft and believe in the evil eye and that kind of stuff. So like I said, it is possible that one of their number had killed the guy.
Right.
But it's also possible that a lot of them didn't know who it was.
Right.
You know, and they were from a small town. They didn't trust outsiders probably and things like that. So there might not have been as much to that as it seemed like. So whether, I don't know, it's like, so whether that was the case, I kind of feel like, you know, in the both cases we talked about, like I said, I wanted to do both of them on one show, not just because I just wrote about them in my book, but also because, you know, they both kind of had different motivations where they could have been a witchcraft murder. I mean, the first one, I don't think it was. I definitely think that was probably more likely to be a Nazi spy type of thing.
Right.
But the second one definitely sounds ritualistic to me. Yeah. I mean, if somebody just wanted that old guy dead, then just hitting him on the head with a cane would have done the trick.
I kind of disagree. I think it was something like crazy teenagers.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. They killed him and had fun with it. And they got away with it. That's what I think. Something like that.
That does, I don't know. That does seem kind of like, I don't know. It just seems so specific the way he was kind of. And like I said, it's hard to tell now because so much legend and rumor surrounds the case. Like I said, some sources say that he had a cross carved in his chest. Some sources say it wasn't there. That he just had his throat slashed.
If you look at just demographics, crime demographics, especially from today, and actually throughout history, a lot of these murders, it's a high propensity of it, or a high proportion of it, is actually crazy teenage men. Crazy teenage boys. They do a lot of it. And it sounds something like that. Maybe they thought he was a witch.
Because like I said, I don't think that's bullshit. I do think people there might have believed that. Yeah. Whether that was justified or not. I don't know if he acted weird. He didn't really seem like he was particularly hated in the town.
Yeah.
But I guess there were rumors swirling around because it didn't take long after he got murdered for some of the townsfolk to be like, oh, he got killed because of witchcraft because he killed the crops last year.
I just got a feeling it was a couple of teenage boys.
Just fucking around?
Yeah, maybe they thought he was a witch. Hey, we're going to take him out. You know, something like that.
And maybe they heard their parents talking about it. I bet it was that Charles Walton guy. Yeah, he's always like with the toads and everything like that.
they took it upon themselves, you know.
Like, well, maybe we need to get in there and take care of that.
Yeah, I think it was something like that.
I love that. It's like, I don't love that people got murdered like that, but I've always kind of liked, that's why I like movies like The Wicker Man and all that. So I love that folk horror, like that old druid sacrifice type
of
shit.
None of this stuff happens in a vacuum. You know,
true.
Once you understand everything behind it, like, you know, when you look at murders that are solved and then they're, you know, you look at everything behind them, you know, all the motivations involved, all the characters and the people involved, they're kind of understandable.
Yeah.
They're a little bit more understandable than you think. Even some of the really wacky ones, you know, some of the serial killer stuff. When you understand how screwed up a lot of the serial killers are, you understand why they did it.
Right? Well, see, that's
you don't justify
what,
it, but you
right you can, and actually, that's what kind of interests me about them. It's like once you understand how their mind works, you understand how they came to the conclusions that they came to, and why they went with the actions they went with. Obviously, you're not justifying it.
No, and a lot of times there's nothing really mysterious about these guys. There's, you know what I mean, like. They're not Hannibal Lecters like you've seen in Hollywood. They're actually pretty dumb.
Yeah.
And pretty mundane. There's nothing really that special about them. I can understand why people are fascinated by the crimes that they commit, but, you
know. Just because it's so out of our personal experience. Yeah. I mean.
But if you ever look at interviews with them, you know, there's not much to those guys.
Yeah, I definitely feel like a lot of people that are into serial killers and, you know.
They make those guys out to be more than
what they are. Well, they glamorize it to some extent. I feel like they do glamorize it. And because the thing is, if you see, like you said, if you see interviews with a lot of these guys, they just seem like.
Like a pathological liar.
Dumbass schlub.
Dumbass schlub slash pathological liar. Yeah. It's the kind of guy that you wouldn't, you know, if you just, you know, saw him in a bar or something, you're like, ah, man, get away from this guy. Get gassed, dude. You know what I mean? They're kind of repellent.
Yeah.
Because, you know, not cool at all. The only one that it was ever captured that was kind of like, or seemed kind of like a regular guy to me, would have been Bundy.
Yeah.
Ted Bundy could pass for a regular guy.
Yeah, he seemed like he could pass for a normal person.
Yeah, at least at first glance. Probably if you hung out with him long enough, you'd probably realize that no, you know.
Yeah, there's something the matter with that guy. Right. But yeah, definitely he did come across as the most normal of the ones that I've seen.
A lot of them just losers. You know, bad losers. Like Charles Ng and Leonard Lake. Losers.
BTK.
Yeah, BTK. Uptight loser.
Yeah. They do, a lot of them do kind of seem like that, don't they?
Right.
Who's the John Wayne Gacy, the clown guy?
Yeah, loser.
Yeah, all those kind of people.
Yeah.
We've done a few shows about some of them.
And the ones that were never caught, like, you know, Zodiac.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting evidence he left behind. You know, but never captured. But probably a loser. Probably a, you know, he made him, you'd be like, you're the Zodiac? Yeah, damn.
What a letdown.
Yeah, what a letdown. Yeah, it's probably like that.
That's pretty sick way to look at that. But you know what we mean. You know what I mean. You're expecting some kind of
Something out of the
monster.
Movies. Something out of the movies, you know.
That's the kind of interesting, that's kind of the interesting thing about a lot of these people that do these kind of murders, not just serial killers, but any kind of people that do these kind of bizarre gruesome murders.
Yeah.
It's like when you don't know who it is,
it
seems like it's gotta be some, like in the movies, it's gotta be like some shadowy, scary monster type figure, and then you see it and it's just some fat bald dude.
Yeah.
You're just like, that's it, that guy? He looks like the guy that works at 7-Eleven.
They're you know, they're overcompensating.
Yeah.
They're trying to compensate.
True.
Is there anything else?
I think so. No, I think that's it.
Let's just plug Patreon again.
Yes, you guys. Okay, so that'll do it for this episode. We hope to enjoy this rather rambling discussion.
Don't forget to check out our Patreon.
Please, please, please go check our Patreon. It's patreon.com.
We've got a really cool Patreon
/ 13 o'clock podcast.
We've got a really cool Patreon pitch video up there, so you can see us.
And like I said, there are a couple of Patreon only posts that we put up there in the last few days. Like I said, one of them was like a half hour thing of us talking about cheesy music documentaries. And the other one was me reading a section of my upcoming true crime book, The Faceless Villain.
So Dan, Veronica, MS, there's new material up there on Patreon. Go check it out.
Yeah, if you want to check it out. And we'll probably, and I'm going to be putting some more up there in a couple of days. I'm going to do one of us talking about horror movies and all kind of fun stuff. All
right.
So I'm going to try and put new stuff up every couple of days. So definitely go check that out. Check out Project Entertainment Network. They have a Patreon also. It's at patreon.com/projectentnet. Go subscribe to our 13 o'clock in minutes video channel and watch the new video that I just put up. And, you know, as usual, like, subscribe, follow. Yeah. Check out zazzle.com/13 o'clock.
And we'll see
check
you guys.
Check out our t-shirts. And we will see you guys
in a couple of days.
Next Tuesday.
Yeah.
Bye.
Thank you.